Let's sit.
No more.
Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is no Let's Talk Social Justice with your host, Kevin Yowie.
Good morning. You're listening to AAA Murray Country. I'm Kevin Yowie, your host for Let's Talk Social Justice. Before we kick things off, I'd like to first begin by acknowledging the Yuggera people as the true owners and custodians of these lands we meet on and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Let's Talk Social Justice will cover topics and issues impacting blackfellas from all over so-called Australia. In this series, we are digging into the violence at the heart of colonial regimes, following it from invasion through the wars fought on the colonial frontiers and the regulation and consolidation of colonial violence through policymaking and policing. Let's Talk Social Justice will be thinking about the gendered dimensions of colonial violence, the construction of race and racial violence, and the occupation and destruction of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's lands and waters. This week on the show, we are joined by an expert on so-called Australia's colonial history and legacy, and the work that goes into telling stories about this history and those who benefit from it. Bachelor artist and researcher Professor Fiona Foley is an award-winning writer, researcher, and exhibiting artist whose works have been provoking critical conversations about colonial violence for decades. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio today, Professor Fiona Foley. Thank you. How are you today?
I'm good, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure seeing you around the community. I was yarning, obviously, before the show, and I think we saw each other at a book launch the last time.
Yeah, we did. It was a good book launch.
Yeah, Professor Watergoes, actually.
Yeah, it was.
Another Day in the Colonies. Professor Foley, first of all, I guess straight off the bat, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your mob, where you grew up and a bit about your work?
I was born in Maribyrra. My family are the Wandunna clan and we come from the Butchler Nation. Our traditional country is all of Gari or Fraser Island, and on the mainland we have boundaries to the north, west and south. So in the north it's the Burrum River, in the west Bopple Mountain, south is Tincam Bay, Double Island Point. And I grew up with my parents, and my mother instilled in all of her children two very important things. One was to be proud of our culture, and the other was to get an education as we went through life, and that would help alleviate, you know, a life of poverty down the track. So she was really strong about indoctrinating all her children that we had to go on to finish high school and then also do a university degree.
Absolutely. Beautiful country up there, Fiona. I was born and bred on Butchler Country as well, in Maribyrra.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I grew up, but I haven't lived in the Bay for, Harvey Bay, that is, for our listeners, for about 20 years. So, yeah. Beautiful country up there.
Yeah, it is. It's lovely.
One of my first actual camping trips with my school was actually over to Gari. And wow. It was beautiful. Like, I think I'd been there a lot as a child, but not with, you know, my school friends or anything. And for some of them, they were the first time and they loved it as well. Do you get back home much?
Yeah, I do. I get back home to do largely these days either photographic or film projects.
Yeah. And do you spend time in Harvey Bay or mostly on the island or a bit of both?
Bit of both. I have a house in Harvey Bay out at Burrell, so I can stay with my nephew who lives there, or I can go across to the island at other times. So I do sort of a bit of both.
Deadly. And again, thank you for joining us. Let's get straight into it. I guess ultimately, you know, your work has obviously been provoking critical conversations in many different spaces. You've got range. You're in academia. You're an artist. You're an active community member. Like I said, I see you lots around community. I'm wondering, one of the pervasive myths about so-called Australia is the idea of peaceful settlement. Fiona, you have engaged this myth in quite diverse ways through your practice as an artist and as a researcher. For our listeners who might not have thought much about this, can you tell us why it is such a problem that mainstream commentators continue to represent the history of so-called Australia in terms of settlement rather than invasion?
Well, it's the English language, isn't it? It's softening the blow of what really took place here. So you see that scattered throughout the historical records. And a good example of that is in government reports in Queensland, I'm referring to as when they would use the word dispersed instead of race murder or massacres. So it's a way to... It's an acceptable way to have a politer conversation in this country without having to dig up the brutality of what really took place here.
Yeah. And is these stories being shared with you? Obviously, you're a researcher and an artist now, but I mean, when you're growing up on Gari and growing up on Butchala country, on your country, have these stories always been shared with you?
No, it was a matter of... piecing the jigsaw puzzle together. None of it was taught to me in the academy or high school education, tertiary education. It's just been a labour of love. So one of the first books I read was in 1984 by C.D. Rowley about the destruction of Aboriginal societies. And there's one chapter on Queensland, and that was the first time I had an inkling of the other story, the you know, the bare facts, the honesty of what really took place in this country. And then that reading took me to other well-known historians like Henry Reynolds or Christine Hulse, Rosalind Kidd, Jonathan Richards, Raymond Evans. And so it's been piecing all of those publications together to understand a fuller picture of what took place here in Australia.
Yeah. Fiona, as an artist and a researcher, a lot of your work has focused on recentering histories of colonial violence that are often obscured and overlooked in the present, particularly those forms of which are represented as benevolent or even progressive. Fiona, can you tell us a bit about why it's so important to challenge these ideas?
Well, effectively, there were different waves of colonisation and they overlapped in different spatial times. So the Native Police Force in Queensland was established in 1849, and then 25 years later, like after the blatant killing of Aboriginal men, women and children, yep, and as the police force... Native police force moved further north and west, that destruction just kept being repeated. So it was like an axological violence, you know, a repetition, repeat, repeat, repeat in different districts. And so 25 years later, you have remnant Aboriginal populations across the state. And what is the what is the way we're going to deal with these remnant populations? So in 1874, you have people identifying islands off the east coast of Queensland as places to relocate surviving Aboriginals as prisoners. So there's a shift in the psychology after the whole-scale murder and massacres that took place in Queensland, then you have to do something with those groups. So, you know, Fraser Island was identified, I'm sure Palm Island was identified, and it's a way of isolating these populations, taking them out of eyesight, so that, you know, real occupation of the land could be conducted. So I'm principally thinking of places like Maryborough. But as a part of that wave of colonisation is also the plundering of natural resources, like let's say the Bunya forests.
Sure.
And so they do that. They set up sawmills. They deplete the stocks of Bunya trees where they can't harvest them anymore because they've taken so many in a period of 10 years.
Yeah, wow.
So you have different competing interests at the same time.
Yep.
And some of it is state and some of it is church.
Yeah. Can you tell our listeners what you mean by that?
Well, you have open-air prisons that are either set up by the church or they're set up as reserves state-run reserves.
Mm.
But both have are not well-funded. So they set up a mission on Fraser Island called Bagimba Creek Mission. It was first run by Archibald Meston to take all of the opium-affected Aboriginal people from across Queensland to this one location.
Mm.
They usurped the Butchler people. Butchler people are in the mix. People are no longer identified by individual names. They're just known as blacks or natives.
Okay.
And, you know, so records are not complete.
Yep.
And then within a span of 2 years, the state government takes control of Bagimba Creek Mission off Archibald Meston and hand it over to the Anglican Church.
Sure.
The Anglican Church under Ernest Gribble is a complete failure, and they decide to close the mission in 1904. But at this stage, Gribble is not physically present on the island because he's running Yarrabah Mission outside of Cairns.
Sure.
So there are many things in place. So the history is complex.
Mm.
The problem in Queensland education system is that we don't delve into any of this complexity.
Absolutely.
We just skim all, you know, skim over the surface.
Yep. I also teach at a university, and you know, on your point about, you know, skimming over the surface and over history, I find a lot of my students, you know, and even students, you know, well into their 40s and 50s, do not know the true history of this place.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And I think there's, it could be changing. I hope it's changing, but I think the work that black academics are doing is sort of setting a precedent where there is change that will come quite rapidly.
Yeah. Fiona, your award-winning 2020 book, Biting the Clouds, provided a Butchler perspectives on the 1897 Aboriginal Protection and Restriction on the Sale of Opium Act, which you touched on. Why do you think it's useful to interrogate these ideas of protection in the context of continuing colonisation? Who was really being protected by these policies?
Well, that's the thing. No one was being protected because they were open-air prisons.
Mm.
It was a slow death. So the state would put them on these isolated outcrops of land that Europeans or white people didn't want. And people were deprived. So there are 70 shallow graves at Bagimba Creek Mission today because they weren't able to feed the population. And under the church, you know, the staple diet for Aboriginal people located there was watered down porridge. People were dying of malnutrition. They were dying from a sedentary lifestyle of hookworm infestation, where the worms would have their larvae in the ground, and the worm comes up through the foot of the human and infests in their stomach, and it's a slow death. So there was no real protection, but what I did look at with that legislation, which has the longest title, the Aboriginals Protection and Restriction of the Sale of Opium Act.
Yeah, take a deep breath.
Was really the aspect of opium. And I wanted to understand, what did opium have to do with Aboriginal people in this state? And opium was legal up until that piece of legislation, and many people were partaking in it. And the reason why is because at some point they allowed Aboriginal people into these townships because they were there was a deficit in labour, so there was a labour shortage. They needed blackfellas to work on the farms, to be a part of the pearling industry, cattle industry, you name it, they needed black labour. And so they had a shift in ideology to allow blacks to come into the townships to work during the days. But a part of that payment was not a monetary system. It was paying them in opium ash or charcoal opium.
For our listeners who don't know what opium is, what is it?
It's a substance that can make you high, I guess. Maybe an equivalent would be marijuana.
Sure.
So it was imported from China, and it would come across as a goods. And the thing with it is that Chinese and Europeans were also involved in its distribution and licensing. The state government licensed the opium for where you could buy it if you had a permit.
Mm.
And so each year the state government would bring in a general revenue of about £30,000,
yep,
which is in the millions today, and that would go into general revenue for the state government. So many people were partaking in it.
And it served a purpose?
Yeah, it served a purpose because you could give this substance that had already been smoked to Aboriginal people. And so my first line of inquiry was to ask a historian, so where are all the opium pipes Aboriginal people had used to smoke opium?
Yeah.
What museums are they in?
Yeah.
And he said to me, matter-of-factly, he said, there are none.
Yeah, okay.
So it sort of made me think, well, how were they ingesting opium if they weren't smoking it?
Yeah.
And he said they would mix the opium ash with water and drink it like a carver concoction.
Oh, yeah.
And so who was smoking the opium? It was white people and Chinese were smoking opium in opium dens, and they were prevalent across the state.
One of your art pieces, I think, has the pipes on it. I think I visited one of your expos here in Brizzy, and, you speak about, exactly this, about, who was smoking it.
Yeah, so, depending on what race you are,
yep,
meant that you came at that use of opium through that particular prism.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about the free labour and you touched on, 1850 and 1849 and the years beyond that. That's the same time South Sea Islanders were enslaved and brought over. On my mother's side, I'm South Sea Islander.
Yes.
And specifically from Tanner Island, and that history of free labour and enslaving people, human trafficking, was very prevalent in so-called Australia, but particularly here in Queensland. And people don't know that history either, because it was about the free labour, it was about the workforce, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the people who devised the legislation for South Sea Islander people was a man called Sir Samuel Griffith, who was the Premier of Queensland twice. He's also the person where Griffith University is named after, and also a street in New Farm.
Yeah, okay, did not know that.
Yeah,
yep.
And so he originates from Wales. And so in some of my reading around the South Sea Islander legislation or acts, he's sort of one of the key figures related to that.
Yeah. Fiona, some of your current work is focused on memorialisation and the practices of national myth. Sorry, let's start that again, Mark. Fiona, some of your current work is focused on memorialisation and the practices of national myth and memory making. For listeners who might not have thought much about this, can you tell us a bit about your current work and the role or memorials and shaping and reshaping colonial history?
Well, as an artist, I've been working in this space for a long time. Let's just say 1986, when I first did a sculpture called Annihilation of the Blacks, which was bought by the National Museum of Australia. It's something that I've been thinking about, this injustice. And then many years down the track, in 2004, I had the opportunity to do a public artwork outside of the Brisbane Magistrates Court, where I could really address, let's look at the first injustices that took place here in Queensland, and that sculpture's called Witnessing to Silence. And in the pavement, it has 94 place names for where massacres had taken place in this state. And as you go on, more people have, more artists have come into the fray and are also working in that space. So there's a number of prominent artists who also work with this type of history of memorialising or remembering Aboriginal deaths through massacre. And I think Aboriginal people have a right to remember. So recently I was awarded a DECRA with the ARC.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. And so the next lot of work over the next 3 years will be 14 short films, and I go to 5 different states, interview Indigenous people associated with a particular massacre. Sometimes there's a memorial at that site and sometimes not. But the important thing for me is to capture a record of speakers today talking about that history and the importance of it and the relevance of understanding that history. So that's a new research project I'll embark on this year.
Yeah.
And a publication will come from that.
Yeah. Fiona, some of the, particularly that work around, you know, researching massacre sites is obviously very heavy and it can be very sensitive, particularly for different people, different countries, different mobs. Is there any sort of process that you go about when you're researching some of this stuff, like in different areas? Is there a bit of a trick to how you conduct some of your research in terms of getting to know the local people or the areas?
First of all, I have to say that I'm pretty steely when I read the information because I've read a lot, so not much surprises me anymore. But what is difficult is when you sit down and talk to people on their own country.
Yeah.
That will stir up emotion in me because I understand the injustices that have taken place here.
Yep.
And I will shed a tear or two. But I try not to over dramatic, you know, just quietly.
Yeah.
And so I do know I have a soul there somewhere.
It's there somewhere.
But it's, yeah, it is difficult information. And, you know, watching that 3-part documentary series recently put together by Rachel Perkins, I had to watch each doco a number of times because I had to write about the series in an opinion piece.
Sure, okay.
And so it was like that information, particularly in Western Australia with what happened in the third series, that really got to me. So it's difficult talking to people on country because it makes it much more tangible.
Yeah, yeah. Fiona, you touched on, you know, obviously some of your art and you've been playing in the art space for decades now. What sort of inspired some of your artistry, and what sort of when you first found a love for it?
I first found a love for it when I grew up with a publication that was in our household. It was written by my great uncle and illustrated by my great Auntie Olga and Uncle Wolfie, and it's recognised as the first publication of a Aboriginal children's book authored by Aboriginal people. So that came out in 1964.
Yeah, okay.
The illustrations are just beautiful, and I was really curious about them, and I would look at them and I would copy them. And at some stage I stopped copying them and started to fantasize about being an artist myself. And I, after high school, I went to art school in Sydney. I did six years of tertiary study, 3 different institutions, 3 different degrees, and then I started to mix in the Sydney art scene, and I was a part of a new cooperative that we formed in 1987 called Bumali Aboriginal Artists Cooperative, and then that allowed me opportunities to travel to remote Aboriginal communities, and I'm thinking particularly of Remanginning and Arnhem Land. I got to know artists there through a number of visits to that location and see them paint, see John Mundine, who was an art and craft advisor, assist those artists in collecting bark, ochres, and getting the bark painting to market. And I just fell in love with a lot of those artists in that community who were bark painters.
Yep.
And I, it's been a growing passion. Like if I have a small art collection of beautiful art pieces that not many people would be aware of, and I can't resist buying Aboriginal art when I go to art fairs like Darwin or Cairns.
Yeah.
And I think as you get older, you also see the role that you could play as a mentor to young people coming through the ranks. So I try to give opportunity where I can. And I know that we talked a little earlier today about Teela Watson.
Yeah, shout out to Teela. She's deadly.
So I had an opportunity to put her in a film called Out of the Sea Like Cloud.
Ooh.
And she devised a song from my mother's Butchler Dictionary.
Yes.
Which was a really big task.
Absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit about the Butchler Dictionary? Because there's a, yeah, I remember going to one of your expos and you touched on this yarn, yeah, for our listeners who may not be familiar.
Yeah, my mother spent 20 years of her life researching and putting this information together from various historians, wannabe archaeologists or anthropologists and early white people who had contact with Aboriginal people in our location, yep. Wide Bay.
Yep.
And she sat about diligently doing that and she produced a word list effectively, and then it was out of print for 23 years.
Ooh.
And then my sister and I, in the International Year of Indigenous Languages 2019, we both found two pools of money and yep. Republished the dictionary.
Love that.
And so I thought, let's do something with this information. I set about to do a short film on the island, Gari, looking at Captain Cook principally when he sailed past in the Endeavour, and he was naming sites. And so one of those sites on the island he named was Indian Head.
Yep.
Which there was an outcrop of volcanic rock, and on top there were about 2,000 Butchler people amassed.
Yeah, okay.
And at that stage they didn't have the name Aboriginal. They thought they looked more like Indians, hence the name.
Sure.
And then so in that view of Captain Cook and the crew looking at us, we were looking at them, and the Butchler people devised a song. And so it was translated many years later, and the first line of the song is Out of the Sea Like Cloud, talking about the sails on the Endeavour being a cloud.
Yes.
So a lot of metaphor in the song. Yep. And then I asked Teela to look at Mum's dictionary and create a song from this word list.
Yeah.
And she did do that.
Yep.
And she sings it beautifully in the film.
Yeah. She's very talented. Fiona, many of our listeners will be tuning into this show after a week of news coverage about the Invasion Day protest and the national holiday on January 26th. To wrap up, can you tell us a bit about why it matters what stories are told and celebrated about the nation's past and whose histories are reflected in the nation's monuments? How do you see these practices of representation shaping broader political dynamics from policing to policymaking to political relations?
That is such a huge question.
Yeah, and you only got 2.4 seconds. Now give it. Nah. What's your take on January 26th, by the way? Obviously, there's a lot of public conversations about the day, whether it should be a national holiday, what we should do on that particular day. This time of year always brings up a lot of conversations around it.
To be honest, I don't really have an opinion about January 26th. My feeling is no matter what day we chose in the year, it would still stir up the same emotion of this conflict that we have that's never been resolved. And I think it would still be, we'd still have these societal tensions. It wouldn't matter what day. You could pick, 20th of March, my birthday, and it would still be provoke.
Sure.
Anxiety.
Absolutely.
Upset. Yes. Anger. Rage.
Yes.
Feeling inconsequential. So most times on January 26th, I choose to stay at home and not see white people.
Yeah.
That's my way of dealing with it. I couldn't be bothered.
Yeah. And you're right. It is something that we have to, as blackfellas, deal with, right? Professor Fiona Foley, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you on Let's Talk Social Justice this morning about your work as an artist, as an academic, and as an activist. Thank you very much for joining me in the studio, and I look forward to catching up with you sometime soon.
Thank you, Kevin. It was great.
Thank you.
No more whispering in our mind. Let's talk Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on Triple A Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on AAA.org.au, proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.